Hey, welcome to another episode of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. We have a lot of work to do today. You'd have to be living on another planet, and even then you'd probably could feel the energy around all the chaos and the destruction and the despair and the difficulty and the triumph and the change that is going on during this time. And these are hard, difficult decisions and chances and choices and conversations that need to be taken care of. And as I've sat back and watched all this, part of my response was to have no response, because I'm very well aware of the fact that there's not much I can do on the macro level, meaning there's, you know, these things that are going on in the world, the difficulties that we are all up against. My job has always been to see the sense buried in the senseless and try to find the obvious in the absurd. It's not always easy to do, and I don't always have an answer for everything. So as I've watched the chaos that has ensued from the murder of George Floyd a week ago, and that's what it is because the officer has been charged, we're calling it what it is, there's been this volcanic eruption of emotion and protesting and looting and all kind of things. Now listen, I'm all about perspective. I'm 61, I'll be 62 this year, so I've seen this before. I've seen it during the Rodney King thing in Los Angeles. I've seen it back in 1968 when I was just 10 years old. Right here in Chicago with the Democratic National Convention. I saw it when RFK was killed. I saw it when MLK was assassinated. So there are things that I've had in my history that I go, well, I've seen this before. And that is why I'm not predicting the end of the world quite yet. To me, these are lessons that need to be repeated until we learn them. We are, history is a great teacher. We're pretty shitty students for the most part. So what I wanted to do around all this was to have conversation with someone who is not like me. When I usually do these shows, for the most part, this is stuff that I do on a solo act. You know, I have a guest here and there, obviously, you know, all know that. But this had to be a different conversation. This could not just be me pontificating, bloviating, and speculating on how I think it should be and what needs to change and pounding the... It's not that deal. So what I wanted to do was have this conversation to see if I can't find some higher ground in all this, because the swamp is full on a lot of levels. And the only way to higher ground is difficult, challenging conversations that we can learn from each other, that we can have some empathy for each other. And that doesn't sell. That's not what CNN, Fox, MSNBC, they don't sell that. That's not what sells, but that is what heals, is having empathy and putting ourselves in one another's shoes and having those conversations to enlighten, inform each other, not just ourselves. So what I did is I went out and found a brother to do this, and it's quite a conversation. And what I'm hoping for today, which I don't do very often, look, hope is great, but it's very open-ended for me. I'm all about concrete, constructive acting. If you see a problem, you insert yourself into the issue. You don't just sit back and bullshit and complain about it, because that changes nothing. I've really minimized my time in the landfill of Facebook and some other things, because this is all very predictable. Something happens, people respond like they always respond, and then it kind of filters off and goes away, and then we go back and forth. It's just this tug of war on both far right and far left, and then most people live in the middle and we get stretched. So there's nothing there for me with that. What there is there, to have this conversation with George Hawthorne, and you're going to hear about him in just a few seconds, and see if we can't come from two different places, even though we have a very similar background, he and I, but it's that kind of thing that has to take place. It's the only saving grace. The public will is far more important than political will. The answers for these problems and challenges we face, especially when it comes to racism and people of color dealing with each other, they're not going to come from some political mandate. There's no bill that could be. We've already tried that, right? And we're the ones that have to figure these things out all these years later. Let's get to it.
How are you?
Hey, George, how you doing, brother?
Man, if I was doing any better, I'd have to pay extra taxes. So I'm doing outstanding.
That's a new one on me. I've heard some good ones, but I've never heard that one before.
Hey, you know, when you do too well, you got to pay more taxes. But, you know, if you understand how taxes work, then you appreciate the fact that you're paying more of them.
I hear you.
And you just adjust with it.
Yeah. All right. You ready to go, big guy?
Always, man.
Now that we're warm. But listen, I got to tell you something. I have such reverence for what you've done for our school, meaning I've seen it. I see it every time you post pictures of these kids that you're coaching. Ray Smith is smiling somewhere, brother.
A lot of what I do came from Coach Smith.
No question.
Coach Smith, and I've told you this story before. Coach Smith was like a father to me. I had a dad. I had a great dad. He was in my life. He was not deadbeat. He was not absentee. Anything I ever needed, that man was there for it. So, but my dad away from home was definitely Coach Smith. I wrestled for him. I played football for him. I wrestled for him, and there was no third season, so I was his girls softball manager.
No kidding.
Yeah, I was with Coach Smith in those 4 years more than I was with anybody else. Mm. Yep, Coach Smith was, I'm going to tell you what, a great man, somebody that I, you know, have a I had a lot of respect for him. I still have a lot of respect for him. I trusted him. I'm going to tell you a story real quick.
Go ahead.
I was my first freshman year wrestling. I was 13 years old, right? Well, I was a big boy. I was 240, 50, 60, I don't know, something in that range. So I'm the heavyweight. There's no other heavyweight in our program at the time. So I'm still, I'm a boy. I'm a kid. I'm
sure.
A soft little kid. I'm 13. Soft feelings. I'm still growing. Still trying to mature as a person. Anyway, I go out to wrestle the first match against Amundsen High School, and everybody wrestles a real competitive match. I think the score's pretty close, like really, really close. Well, Coach Smith comes to me and he says, "George, all you got to do did not get pinned, and we win this match."
Mm-hmm.
I go out. Well, I'm waiting through all the wrestlers. My turn comes, and this was abnormal for this match. I mean, it hadn't happened in this match. Anyway, the lights go out. They turn the lights down, and then they start stomping on the benches, and they start stomping moose, 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 moose. So that's the kid I'm wrestling. They call him Moose.
Oh God.
Moose was a guy who was probably about 19, I'm guessing.
Oh, boy.
He had hair on his chest. Basically, the hair is coming out of the singlet. That's how much hair he had on his body. Right? Now, you got to understand, I'm a little boy that didn't even have, I don't even know if I have pubic hair yet. And that's true. So I go out against Moose, and I get pinned in like no time flat. I don't know what he did. I still to this day don't know what he did or how I got underneath him. I'm under his belly. He's got a big old belly. At the time, a heavyweight was unlimited. Big old belly, man.
Yeah.
And I'm under his belly. I can't breathe. I'm trying to put my shoulders to the mat as quick as I can. Because it seems like forever when you're under there and you can't breathe, right?
Right.
And so I bite him. I get up. I'm hysterical. I'm crying. I'm crying, because I'm scared. I'm a little boy that's scared, And everybody in the room could beat me, by the way. I mean, any weight. It didn't matter. I mean, the Carnoots, they were really good. But it didn't matter. They probably could beat me in that room.
Yeah.
So I get up, I'm crying. On the middle of the mat, in the middle of Amundsen High School Arena, I'm crying. Coach Smith comes up to the middle of the freaking mat, man, and he puts his arm around me and says, "It's okay, son," and walks me off the mat. It's okay, son.
Wow.
And I'm going to tell you, at that point, you needed that protection. Because you were vulnerable. You were crying in front of, you're in high school now. That's unacceptable. But I was crying, emotionally crying in front of, the whole arena of people.
Sure.
And all of my teammates. But that man, instead of breaking me, he could have came on the mat and said, "You don't cry on my mat. This is a man's sport." You didn't do that, man. He came, he put his freaking arm around me, walked me off the mat, and said, "It's okay, son."
Mm.
And consoled me. That's the true story, and that's why I coach football. That's why I coach kids. Because at a time when I really, really needed that somebody there to support me emotionally, the manliest man in the school did it.
Hmm. I was up.
And, you know, I'll never, ever forget that story as long as I live. And I'm going to tell you, that's what gained my trust for Coach Smith, because he protected me at a very vulnerable time when I was unable to protect myself.
And I see Coach Prio quite frequently. He's doing well. I just saw him a week ago. We talk about this at length, this intangible, almost undefinable spirit that makes guys like you go out and carry on the legacy of what they were there. You know, we were only there 48 months out of our life. And look at the impact of spending time with these guys and that school has done. So you coach to this day because of that time there. I mean, that's really, and a lot, you mentioned the Carnuths. All these guys are going out and do great things in the world. You know, we have this organization, and I'm not going to turn this into a Shurs alumni show, but the bottom line is I haven't run across anybody from our time there and around that time that isn't finding ways to make concrete, constructive, positive differences in the world. It says a lot for where we went to high school, brother.
It does. It does. And you know what? We were blessed to have those caring guys in our lives, those guys that actually care. And, you know, and that was my experience with Coach Smith wasn't unique,
right,
as you just said.
Right.
I watched him do it with dozens of kids in my time there, you know, similar things. And, you know, again, that gained my trust. And you know what? I wanted to be just like them.
There you go.
You know? And then, you know, obviously I was blessed to go on and have other great coaches that cared about making great men. And, man, I can't complain. That's why you asked me, how am I doing, man? How could you be doing bad?
I hear
when
you
had those people in your life, those types of experiences, you know?
For me, it's just all I have to do is hear Prio's voice. He calls me on the phone, I'm ready to go run laps, George.
That's what you tell. That's what you say. Every time I read, you know, obviously I read your post.
Yeah.
And every time you go visit him, you say, I was ready to strap it up right then, you know?
Man. And then, yeah, I was with him on his deck a couple weeks ago, and Jack Olerquire, who was a coach, I don't know if he was there when you were there, he might have been gone already. And a guy named Rich Hill was there. Rich played in 1966, brother. And, you know, so we covered the gamut of character, really, at that school. And let me just leap off into why I asked you to come on today besides, you know, doing the rah-rah for our Bulldogs. Outside of the fact that, you know, you went to the College of DuPage and then you went to the All-American team in 87, you got 2 years in a community college, you went on to University of Iowa, full scholarship, man. Dan Gable wrestling, Hayden Fry head coach, the hair on my legs is standing up. And then, after 3 years at the U of Iowa, you were given the opportunity to join the Cleveland Browns as an undrafted free agent. You were coached by Belichick, and you were coached at the Arizona Rattlers by Danny White, the famous quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. That's a long way from Milwaukee and Addison, man.
Hey, I agree. It is. You know, I feel blessed to have taken that journey. And you know what? Everybody along the way was responsible for each step in that journey, you know? And, I can't even thank God enough for what I've gone through. You know, sometimes I tell people what I've done. Like, somebody will start talking about wrestling, I tell them I wrestled with Dan Gable.
Mm-hmm.
And then most people are like, sure you did. Or, you know, that same person to have a conversation about football, you know, maybe they'll be talking about the Patriots. And I say, yeah, I played for Belichick. Sure you did.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel like a liar.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Just because every great person in the game you had something to do with. You know, I say, well, Nick Saban was on the staff at Cleveland. Sure he was.
You know, but that stuff doesn't last forever. And one in a thousand, we all know this, that ever played football. You know, we all wanted to, you know, I was pretty sure the Bears were going to take me number three in the draft in 1978. And Hanson Stadium's AstroTurf put an end to all that stuff. I ended up playing, you know, at Division III at Northeast Illinois University. It was our first year as the division champs, AI. So I was glad with that. But eventually everything changes. And you moved into law enforcement. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I had to go back and look. I think this is, for me, the leap-off point of this conversation, the reason that I, besides catching up on all this stuff, that I asked you to come on, because you have a truly unique perspective that most people don't, that are talking about all the things that are going on in the world today when it comes to race relations and the difficulty that we seem to have that's been going on for as long as I can remember. But I want to go back to Shurs for a second, because when I was there, I took a look at the football team pictures from when I played 75, 76, and we were the 76 team, but we graduated in 77. And we had blacks and Hispanics and Polish and white and across the board. And I don't remember anybody being treated in any way less than as long as they could play football. I don't remember any problems in the school at that time. It doesn't mean they weren't going on in the world, but in that little microcosm of Shurs where I was going to high school, we just, nobody cared as long as you play football. Didn't really care what color your skin was. Was that the same for you? Did you have the same type of experience? I'm sure Smitty and Prio made sure that was the way it was, but when you were there in the 80s, was that still intact?
Yes, sir. Sports, you know, I think it's sports. Sports is a unifying thing. You know, I've had people play next to me, not as sirs necessarily, but later on in my career, I've had people play next to me that I knew, you know, had racist tendencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you a story. And Shurs was absolutely great. And they were my brothers then, and they're my brothers now. And we had very few race issues. I can't remember a race issue as it pertains to the Shurs Bulldog wrestling team, football mm-hmm. team, or anything else. Everybody was, it was all inclusive in what I was doing. You know, when I went to Portage Park, and I did have race issues at Portage Park.
Really?
But there was no sports. I wasn't involved in any sports.
Hmm.
So there were race issues at Portage Park, but then when I went to Shurs and I was part of the athletic programs, I had no race issues.
Hmm.
You know, it was a huge difference. But I played next to a guy in junior college, and again, you know, I knew that he had some issues. One day we were in a game, and I didn't even hear it. I guess some player on the other team, the opposing team, called me the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, his name was Kurt, he got so enraged, right? And again, this is words that he's never used that word in front of me, but this is words that, you know, I'm pretty sure he's used.
Yeah.
And he got red and he got mad. He was the guard. He was my guard, you know, mm-hmm. right next to me. He's not one of them. You don't call him that.
Whoa.
He's not one of them. And I had to calm Kurt down. I was like, Kurt, don't worry about it. It's okay, buddy. It's okay. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Come on, Kurt. Kurt, come on. It's okay. And, you know, but that's what sports does. Sports is very unifying.
Yep.
And although, like I said, Kurt might have had some different views, but when it came to his teammates,
yep.
it was none of that stuff was tolerated.
I was,
you know.
I've been fortunate to be friends with the celebrated Hall of Fame guard for Vince Lombardi, Jerry Kramer, for 30 years I've known the man. And Willie Davis has just passed away this year. He was like 85 years old. The defensive end for Lombardi's Packers for a decade. And Jerry and Willie, outside of Piccolo and Sayers, were the other two integrated roommates. And to be in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where you could walk on water, basically, I always asked him, he said, was there any problems with that? He said, you know what? First of all, if there was, we never heard it. Lombardi wouldn't allow it, number one. Number two, he said, we really felt like, what's the big deal? We never got being a white man and a black man. We were just football players. We played to play football. We're not here to set a standard for society. We're not here to be an example. But we realized pretty soon that it was so unusual. Now, this is in the 60s, but he was just my brother. There was nothing there, so we couldn't understand why it was such a problem outside of the team, and I think that's what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're on the field and you're part of a team, you know, in the locker room, it's just you're a Bulldog, you're a Hawkeye, you're a, you know, Rattler, you're a Brown. You know, race is not a factor. You know, I've been fortunate enough to be part of mostly good teams. You know, the good teams that I've been a part of, then those little things are never a factor. What's the bigger thing is competition, winning, playing together, a brotherhood. You know, on some of the bad programs I've been in, those things are factors in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those teams usually don't win very many games when you have those types of issues.
Right.
You're not unified in what you're doing. And I'm going to tell you, most of the people that I have played with, you know, their views are more open today. And I think partly because of their experience.
Yep. Yep. I've never figured it out. I don't want to figure it out. But that's the deep end of the pool. This is the this is kind of the buildup to me to say, listen, you know, I've only met you a handful of times in person, right? So the first time I knew of you, but the first time we actually met was at Ray Smith's memorial, which is that's 7 years ago, man. And then we do the Bulldog Bash once a year. You've made a couple of those and back and forth. And, you know, again, you could go back to 1966. Rich Hill's, you know, he's 10 years older than both of us. He's 20 years older than you and 10 more than me. And there's this common bond there. So that's always intact. But that outside of our little area there of safety, where whoever walks in the front door when we do the Bulldog Bash, I don't give a shit what color you are. I don't care if you changed your gender. You're part of Bulldog Nation. So that's a very unique set of rules that we have that doesn't matter. Outside of that, though, things get kind of dicey. And I was looking at this post that you put up yesterday. I watch all your stuff, too. But listen, so I'm going to put a disclaimer here because I don't want to sound stupid. My job on this show, as I've always done on radio for 20 years, is to try and make sense out of the senseless, to dig for the obvious truths that are so deeply buried oftentimes in the absurdity of the lives we lead. And so any of the questions I have for you come out of total respect because you have experiences I don't have. And I want to at least have people be able to tune into this and go, it's not just John running his mouth off and talking about this, talking about that. I'm talking with you because you experiences as a law enforcement officer for 25 years, as a black law enforcement officer, as a coach, you know, as a father yourself, you have these experiences that when I watch on Facebook, all the people jump into the landfill and have their posturing and their opinions, mine included, they all come from a place of not having those experiences. So yesterday, it was 2 days ago, I was reading a post you put up. If you don't mind, I'm just going to read it as you wrote it. I'd like to know how Colin Kaepernick was likely banned for his nonviolent protest. MLK was killed for his nonviolent protest. Houses and churches have been burned down for their nonviolent protests. Black Wall Street was burned down for its nonviolent protests. Neighborhoods burned down and terrorized for their nonviolent protests. People have been shot, hung from trees, castrated for their nonviolent protests. Schools have been burned down for their nonviolent protests. It goes on and on. School children's killed. Athletes and actors have been ostracized. And all this nonviolent stance with so much violence attached to it now. So can we at least come from a position to start with the number one question? Is it possible, do you think at all? I mean, you and I, we have no problems. I don't know how problems occur in the world like this because I'm coming from this side of the fence. Help me, help us take a little deeper look at the words you wrote and why they exist.
Well, the words I wrote is just to make people think. You know, everybody's saying that, that these people are thugs, they're, you know, hoodlums, they're, you know, all the negative things that go with it. But what people have to understand, and what I'd like for people to understand is just start thinking, that comes from a lot of years of oppression. And when you oppress something for so long, eventually it's gonna explode, it's gonna burst, it's gonna, you know, do whatever it has to do to get out of this situation. It's gonna fight back. Listen, I don't like violence. I wish violence didn't have to be a part of it. And it doesn't. It doesn't have to be a part of it. And I'll tell you how it could not be, and I'll get to that. But that's what happens when you oppress people for so long. Now, if you're not one of the oppressed, then sometimes it's hard to see the oppression when you're not on that side.
Can you say that again?
Say that when again. You're not part of the oppressed, it's hard to see the oppression.
Man, okay.
And it's the truth, because you're looking from a perspective that doesn't have the experience to necessarily know what the others are going through. Like, John, I can't claim to know what your life is like.
Right.
You know, we talk about white privilege and all of those things, right? I can't claim to know what if there is such a thing as white privilege. I can't claim to know what it's like, because I'm not white, and you know what? I've mm-hmm. never lived in that type that situation or in that demographic. So I can't explain it. I can't, you know, I can't understand it.
Right.
I just need people to be a little bit more open minded and try to have empathy. I have a saying that, and I'm sure it's not unique to me, but perception is reality to the perceiver.
That's right.
So let's find out why the perception exists, as opposed to telling people that they're crazy, that it doesn't exist, that there's no race issues in this. Everybody's treated equally. Well, it's easy to say when you're not the person being pulled over
right
at every time you drive through a neighborhood and, you know, you get a double take and now a cop turns, you know, makes a U-turn and gets behind you and pulls you over. Although you're doing your best to follow every traffic law and every, you know, every rule in the book, but yet you still get pulled over. That's very frustrating, and you feel very helpless. And I'm going to tell you, it's an experience that I've had the experience personally, even while working in law enforcement. I've had that experience. And I've asked the officer, well, what did I do wrong? You know, and, you know, they usually find something to make up. And I say, well, I actually didn't do that. And I don't argue, you know, because I know better. And I just write a letter to, you know, that agency and say, hey, you know what, I was pulled over this night for this reason. And you know what, I wasn't doing that. What happens with that officer at that point, I don't know. But it's frustrating when you live with that and that happens to you time and time again. You know, so now you have that personal experience. Now you watch that on television and you just think that that could be you. You know, when I watched the George Floyd situation, you know, he wasn't much younger than me. Yep. I got a friend that actually knows him and knows the family because he went to Jackie Yates. So he knows George Floyd. He played football with me at Iowa, Melvin Foster. And, you know, it's just when you see that, it hurts. It hurts you as a person to see it. Now, I think it should hurt every person. But unfortunately, we're so disconnected as a society, it doesn't hurt every person. Empathy is missing in our society. I'm going to tell you one of the things that another saying that I have. And you probably read this one. This was last year. Division is the greatest weapon of evil.
Yes.
The very first thing that has to happen is we have to become divided. And once we become divided as a society, as a community, as a whatever it is, once we become divided, we become weak. So now all of our vulnerabilities can be exploited. And that's what's happening. We're being divided. Right now, we're being divided by race. And I'm going to tell you, the media is the greatest at dividing. And the reason the media divides, because the middle does not sell newspapers.
Hey, man, listen.
The middle.
Listen, I've been in the media. This is my expertise. And as long as you were in law enforcement, I've been that long in the radio business. And I 100% agree. If people knew how it actually worked from the inside out, much like your business, the inside in, they would, you know, I don't know if it would change their viewing habits, but there are reasons why things are positioned a certain way. And talk radio, you know, it's filled with people who know everything about everything but haven't done a damn thing. That's by design because it sells. But go ahead.
Yep, the media, like you said, it sells. It's by design, it sells. The media, even though sometimes the actual reporter doesn't even believe what they're reporting on or they don't believe the position that they're taking, but they know that that position is going to get viewership.
That's right.
And it's gonna elicit emotion. Without eliciting emotions, you turn the channel.
That's right.
But if I can get your emotions up, you're going to stay. And the best way to get the emotions up is by choosing a side, regardless of if I believe that side or not.
Right.
The very best way to get emotions going is by choosing a side. So the media, just by its current purpose, divides us as a society. And unfortunately, a lot of people just believe whatever they hear.
Yep.
You know, where you may be a Fox News person, a CNN person, a, you know, a CBS person, but whatever they're reporting, you're going to believe. If I'm a Fox, you know, if I'm a conservative news person, then what they're selling on conservative news, then I start believing it because they're very convincing. Their job's to report it, to seem credible. So if they tell you that these people are just lazy and they're looking for a free ride or that these people are thugs and they should be put in jail, then you know what, that's what you believe. But nobody's talking about empathy, that you should start thinking about where these people came from and what they've gone through. You know, just like my traffic stop, you feel helpless. And you have people can say, well, it's just a traffic stop. Well, you know what, but you still don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of uncertainty in that traffic stop. I've been stopped so many times and I've been threatened to, you know, I've been a law-abiding citizen for, you know, all my life. I've, of course, made mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been threatened by police to, well, I'll put this on you, or I'll say you had this, and I'll take you to jail, and you'll do prison time, or you'll you know, go to jail for a long time. Let's see how you like that, you know. And I've always been a pretty good person and pretty respectful, but I've still had those types of encounters. And, you know, again, you can say, well, that's just one bad cop that pulled you over. But, you know, it's happened time and time again in various jurisdictions, in various cities. You know, so we can say it's just one bad cop, or we can say that, you know, there is a problem.
Yeah. Last week, when all this was really in the thick of it, a mutual alumni of ours, she was a classmate of mine, put up a post that she was a great picture of her three boys. These kids are all in their, you know, 30s and I guess in 40s probably now at this point, 30s for sure. And these were some bright looking, great looking guys that were just, they were fantastic. And she was writing on there, she said, see this picture of my three sons? But this is the life they've lived. And she went down the list just like you have about being stopped and all the things for no reason. And then, you know, turned loose, but it was a constant harassment. And that harassment, that pressing on people, that oppression of people, bends your behavior. You can't not help but respond to that or react to it one way or the other. And I sent her a private note. I said, as a father, I'm heartsick. I look at these boys, and my son didn't have to go through that, George, ever. And to see the looks on their faces and the smiles on their faces and the energy they exuded in spite of all that stuff was like, at one point, sickening that they had to go through it. And the other point was like, well, this is what the human spirit's about. They're overcoming this in spite of those things. And what you said before about, I can't possibly understand what it feels like because it's never happened to me. And yet we still come on you with an opinion saying, well, I don't understand this. It should be this, because we have no reference points to these things. So moving on from that, is there, you know, how do we even begin? This has been going on for so long. And it, like, it bubbles underneath the surface until there's another death. Or there's, you know, I was the other day, I went and looked online. I looked for an hour to see if I could find any videos of black officers doing anything close to what happened to Mr. Floyd at all. You know what? There aren't any. And what I did find, though, was this video recently of Christian Cooper, the black man who was out bird watching. And he asked the woman to put her dog on a leash because he was a little concerned. And she started saying, I'm going to call 911 and tell me that you're threatening my life. He's a bird watcher. He's minding his own business. Then I found the video of Ahmaud Arbery, the young black man out jogging. He was gunned down. And then I found the video of Mikel McIntyre, black man, gunned down by Sacramento County deputies in 2017. 7 bullets at him, 6 in his back. And then here in Chicago, the whole world back in 2014 was Laquan McDonald. And they shot him walking away, but until the dash cam video was released because it leaked out, the cops would have walked. He was shot 16 times. So it's hard for me to sit here as a white man and say, gee, these people are sure acting out of character because I wouldn't do that. That's really stupid and ignorant. On the other hand, and part of it is like, if this has been going on so long, where do we, George, even begin to heal these wounds? And is that even possible?
John, I think the wounds will always be there. But I think if we unite it and we demand it, equal treatment in our society for all people, that would go a long way. Just like the story I told about Coach Smith, how he had my back and I gained trust for Coach Smith because of it. Well, it's the same thing now. You know, if all people would stand up and say, you know, hey, you know what, that type of treatment for any person isn't right. And I'm going to tell you, those wounds will start healing quicker. Again, they'll always be there because we're talking, John, we're talking history of 300 years of those types of things, you know, where we've watched hopelessly where, you know, our mothers were taken away, our children had been ripped from us, our, you know, fathers had been beaten and made to be submissive to whatever, rapes. We're talking hundreds of years of oppression. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think I don't think you could solve 100 years of oppression in one generation or even one, you know, one day. Sure. One generation, one decade. I think it's just consistency and again, empathy and compassion. And you know, caring about your fellow man. Nobody's asking you to give up anything you have. You know, me becoming equal doesn't mean you become less.
That's right.
A lot of people confuse that, the two things. They think, and because, you know, that's how the caste system was set up. But they confuse that if I become equal, then you become less. Back in the slave days, they would take poor white people, and this is how they made poor white people feel better. They would then make that person the overseer. So the overseer, although he had no more than the slaves, he then felt like he was somebody, like he was more than that slave who he had no more than.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a caste system that was set up by, again, those people that were running things back then, by the slave owners, just to make that person feel more. And now, because I've made him feel more, although I don't, at the time, you know, as the slave owner didn't consider that poor white person equal to him, but he knew he'd be able to get that poor white person to do whatever he needed him to do because he had given him a title. He had given him a feeling of being better. And so then, you know, you wouldn't have those people banding together with slaves to, you know, come up right. with ways to, you know, revolt and that type of thing. So the caste system has always been there. The very best thing to do right now, in my opinion, is for people to have some empathy and try to look at things from a different perspective. As you just told the story about the lady with the three sons, who, you know, kind of illustrated what her sons had gone through. Well, you had some empathy. You put yourself in her position and says, man, I can't imagine if my sons had to go through that. You know, and I think when you do that, John, I think that changes your perspective. It also makes you understand a little bit more what those people, what people are going through when they go through those types of things. Mm. I got to tell you a story.
Sure.
I had a kid. I worked for, you know, obviously the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, and we were one of the first agencies in the country to do, local agencies in the country to, you know, do immigration. At least we got the most publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked for Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and he was really big on immigration. And, you know, you get into the situation of groupthink, and that's what a lot of police get into. You know, the people around you, they're talking about how bad it is and how these people shouldn't be in our country and how, they don't deserve to be here. They didn't come in legally, that type of thing. So you start buying into it because that's what you hear. You hear that every day. You're not hearing an opposing side. You're just hearing the negative. And so, you know, me, like everybody else, I was in the beginning starting to believe what I was hearing. And I also coached football at this time. Well, one of my favorite players comes to me and he says, Coach, I'm scared. And I asked him, I said, Carlos, why are you scared? You know, well, I was brought here when I was 2 weeks old by my parents from Mexico, and, you know, I don't have papers. And they're pulling people over every day and sending people back to Mexico. Well, Coach, I was in Mexico when I was 2 years old. I don't know anybody in Mexico. I was scared. I mean, I was 2 months old or 2 weeks old or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm scared, you know. And Carlos was a kid. He graduated in the top 10% of his class. Hmm. He had 2 to 3 jobs. He was very obedient. He contributed. He paid his taxes. He did everything he can do as a person to be great. That changed my views on the immigration thing. Mm-hmm. Another team I had, this was a different team, a high school team. We went to Yuma, which is down near the border, to play a team, and they wouldn't get on the bus. It was about 9 or 10 Hispanic kids that wouldn't get on the bus. Didn't understand why until one of the kids that did trust me came to me and said, Coach, we don't have papers.
Oh, wow.
If we get on the bus, Coach, and this is a team sport. They gave up a football game in their life because they're afraid. You know, and none of these kids, all of these kids, great English speakers, great, mm-hmm. you know, great citizens. They've chosen to do extracurricular activity for their team, but they wouldn't get on the bus because they were afraid they would be deported. You know, now listen, no fault of these kids' own. They were here. They were here. They were doing the right thing in life. But now they're afraid they're going to be deported. So that changed my view. Empathy. changed my view of that situation.
Let me share this with you, which is a different side of the fence, because now I'm over here. And this goes back to Schurz High School. So we've been doing this Bulldog Bash since Ray Smith passed. And we raise a bunch of money for the school. We have a great time. You know, you were there. We all get to hang out. We raise a bunch of money and like that. So last year, we decided to do scholarships. And we were going to do five $1,000 scholarships, the Bulldog scholarship, the Bulldog Alumni Scholarship. And all the details really don't matter, but we got to the point where we knew we could cover five scholarships. And Tim Anderson, who was my co-captain in 1977, is the music teacher there. And there's a few more people that are kind of holdovers from back in a different time are still teaching there. And they went through the process. And we had like the kids actually had to go through a process to see if they'd qualify, whatever, and write different things. And so anyway, we ended up at the Schurz Library, which I didn't spend a lot of time in, brother, when I was there, if you get my drift. You know what I'm saying? I was more in the weight room. Actually, we didn't even have a weight room, George. We had a universal machine. That was it.
We had the same machine.
Same machine in the corner of the big gym?
Well, they moved it to the wrestling room by the time I got there, yes.
Yeah, same machine. So anyway, we're sitting in the library. It's myself, and there's four or five other people on our little committee. And they had chosen nine kids to qualify for five $1,000 scholarships. So four kids aren't getting anything. And this was the Sunday before Memorial Day, literally the day before Memorial Day 2 years ago. And these kids took buses to get there. Some of them already, they were all going to college, but they took buses to get there. They got dropped off. Some took three or four buses to get back to Schurz on a Sunday, right? So one of the guys that was there is the late, great Phil Larson. Phil, you probably met him when you were in last time, but he passed away just 3 weeks ago. We played together on a 75 team, and he was only 62, and he was just an integral part of what we did as a unit to do these things for the alumni. And so it was myself and Phil and three or four of the other ladies that were there. And Phil was as conservative, hard rock as you could get. And he made no bones about it, but he had a huge heart. So we all, you know, we'd always didn't see eye to eye, and I never did politics stuff with him. But we came from a common background, went to grammar school together, went to high school together, played ball together, reconnected after many years, and he was really dug into this and helping out. And before we had this meeting at the library, George, they sent us the bios of these kids. And he called me. He's like, Augie, I don't like any of these kids. First of all, you know, they all come from Mexico. And their parents came from Mexico. I don't know if these kids are this. You know, they're DACA kids, and I can't get behind that. And I said, Phil, you need to do what you got to do. If you want to opt out of this to save your conscience, you go ahead. And oh, no, I'll follow it up. He was the first guy in the door at Schurz waiting for these kids, number one. And number two, he had more questions lined up for them than any of us put together. He ran them up and down. What about this? What about that? And he took notes, and we just all kind of sat back going, wow, this is really interesting. And when we finished with those nine kids, it took about 3.5 hours. Patty Annis, whose husband Carl and I went to school together, and unfortunately Carl's no longer with us, he ran the music academy. She slams her hands down and says, I'm paying for the other four kids out of my pocket, $4,000. So all nine kids got $1,000 for their chosen college. That's a big deal. But what the bigger deal for me was, Phil pulls me aside afterwards. He goes, Augie, I was wrong about every one of them. They all deserve every support we can possibly give them. Their parents brought them here, or they were born here. They're not, you know, they didn't have a card. They're not citizens. They're working on their citizenship. He said, their hardship cases are nothing compared to what I've put up to in my life. And they're still going to college. So to see, you talk about empathy a little bit ago. This is a guy I was very close to the last 7 years. I'm still having a difficult time to think that he's not here, but I saw him transform in a situation he was not comfortable with. And that is part of the reason I think maybe one-on-one, this conversation we're having, the conversations we can have with people we care about and to share these kind of things, maybe, you know, I'm not expecting the government to come up any mandate about empathy, but I think you may have hit the nail on the head that if we can put ourselves in each other's shoes a little bit as a father, as a parent, as a brother, a sister, a mother, whatever, skin color becomes not relevant.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's my whole point is, if people can experience what Phil experienced, then people will change. Things, their perspectives will change. The only reason our perspectives are narrow is just because we haven't gotten another one. We haven't opened our hearts or our minds to listen to other perspectives. that kid I told you about, that Carlos kid that played for me, and the first kid that I had to, you know, experience that immigration issue with, Carlos last week. Now, remember, this was 12 years ago he played for me.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, Carlos texted me and said, Coach, this was during the COVID thing, so it might have been 2 weeks ago. Coach, I just wanted to let you know because you're so important to me. You're such an inspiration to me, and you're so important in my life. Today, I'm getting my citizenship.
Oh.
Yes. Hmm. 12 years later, Carlos got his citizenship. Carlos and I started working on it then. At that time, for him and his family, you know, going through it, I hooked him up with an immigration lawyer, or I tried to hook him up with an immigration lawyer. And again, he started working on it at that time. 12 years later, he gets his citizenship.
12 years.
Yes. But he, you know, it's just a great story. And it is what changed my position. It's one of the things that changed my position on the immigration thing. Again, my perspective was very skewed because I only heard from the people that I worked with and you know, talk radio and
sure.
that type of thing. And they, you know, again, talked about how they're here stealing our resources and, yeah. and they're here, you know, making our hospitals crowded. And I was like, man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And again, as I educated myself to it and I became empathetic to the situation and understood that, you know, first Carlos put money into a system for a very long time that he got no returns from. And there's a lot of people like him that did the same thing. So is he really a drain on our resources? He wasn't. And most of the people that come here aren't. So anyway, that's where my empathy came from. And that's why I at that day, I understood that, you know, I needed to open my mind and see all sides of that situation before I made the decision.
Let me wrap up with this because this is something that is, you know, in this day and age, because everything is so fast, I felt we were better off when we only had four channels, three newspapers. All this stuff that's going on, in my opinion, and this is my side of the fence, brother, it's always been there. Now there's just more outlets for it. So on some level, the hate and the racism and all the other shit that goes on in the world has always been there, as you pointed out. It's just there's more places to find it now, and it's very select. If you like this, you go here. If you like this, you go here. Getting people educated, I thought at one point, wow, this internet thing's going to be really cool. We'll have access to all this information, and we can make some great intellectual leaps in the world. That hasn't happened so much. I don't know. It just divided people even further. It's just another platform to put up whatever you think is true. Education is a pretty long slog. But one of the things that happens is people will put a meme up, a picture of something with a quote, a part of a quote, and that's the only way they can express themselves. And that's not inherently a bad thing. But these quotes by MLK Jr. have been popping up in response to the murder of Mr. Floyd. And the most prominent one, or the most popular one I've seen, comes from this Other America speech that's been shared all over Twitter and places like that, actually from the King Center. And in the speech, MLK emphasized his support for nonviolent tactics in the struggle for freedom and justice. And he also expressed his disapproval for riots and referring to them as socially destructive. He wins the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. 48 months later, he's shot to death on April 4th, 1968, by a white man, James Earl Ray, at the age of 39. All his nonviolent protests and peace movement meets with a violent end. Then you go down the list in history. Medgar Evers, Gandhi, Malcolm X, go look, they're all over the place. Just you can go to Wikipedia and find a list of assassinated human rights activists. It's like 400 or 500 people. And so on one hand, they're talking about how MLK never threw a brick, didn't turn over a cop car, didn't set buildings afire and change the world. And I'm saying, again, my perspective, George, this is for you to jump in on. My perspective is, well, not much has changed in the last 50 years since this has happened. What do you say to all that?
John, did you know the year, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but did you know the year that MLK was assassinated, he was actually on the list of one of the most hated Americans at that time?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. He was hated by a large, by a high percentage of Caucasian white people, and he was also hated by a high percentage of black people. It's easy to look up. It's in the Smithsonian, so it's not something that you can't look up.
Yep.
He was actually on the list. And a lot of people don't know that. After Dr. King died, and of course I was too young, I think I was one, but after Dr. King died, that's when the approval rating went up. Everybody said he was the greatest. He was, but again, once he died, what happened, John? People had to pay attention, you know, because when they killed Dr. King, what happened in America? Riots every place, right?
Ben, I was just going to say, Ben, I was going to tell you, I was 10 years old, and I actually was hoping you'd bring it up because I remember seeing the headlines. I lived here in Chicago, the Democratic National Convention, so I was 10. This is all vivid. They burned Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, Louisville, Kansas City, across the board. So when I see this going on, I'm going, obviously MLK had a huge impact. As you say, after he died, then all of a sudden he became this iconic figure. But here we are, all these years later, and the same thing's happening.
You know why? Because we made no changes. We've made very little changes to truly bring equality. I mean, now you might say, well, what do you mean no equality? You were a captain with the sheriff's office. You know that you have opportunity. You got to play, you know, in the NFL. You got to go to college. That's equality right there. But true equality across the board for all people, we've made very little freaking progress towards that. Yeah. We've made very little progress as people to understand positions of other people. And we've made very little progress as people to be less selfish and say, okay, just because my neighbor does well, that's not going to keep me from doing well. And what a lot of people don't understand is that a rising tide raises all ships. So if I can help my neighbor to be better, just like I'm helping these kids that I coach to be better, then I live in a better country because of it.
Right.
And, you know, there's more opportunity for me.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is I mentioned the Other America speech and some of the things that Dr. King said, but what's often overlooked from that speech are these words. And he said, quote, in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? He said that in 1961. So here we are all these years later, and I'm asking you, George, as a brother, as a friend, as a bulldog, what is it that we're not hearing that you think we need to hear?
You're not hearing our pain, our position. You're not hearing the fact that we are treated different. You're not hearing, you know, that we are discriminated against. You're not hearing that when I go into a job, when I go into a job interview, I'm often canceled out even before I get there or as soon as I get there. You're not hearing that, you know, I get pulled over by the police. It's not the same encounter as it is when you get pulled over by the police. You're not hearing that people view me different than they view you. People view me as a threat immediately. You're not hearing that. You know, my jail sentences for the same exact crime are often a lot longer than your jail sentences. My opportunity or opportunity to be paroled is a lot slimmer than your opportunity to be paroled. You're not hearing that, you know, education-wise, that I can't get the same education in my neighborhood that I can get, that you can get in your neighborhood. You're not hearing that, you know, when I grew up, I would get books from the North Side with things written in it. You know, we'd get the used books, you'd get the new book. You're not hearing the disparity that happens in society. So that's what most people aren't hearing because they just ignore it. They're not living it. So they don't know that I got books when I was a kid that had little N written in it or little, I don't use racial terms, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Yep.
But that I had, you know, little N or stupid N, you'll never learn, you know, those types of things. Teachers did their best to watch for that, but it still would come up, sure, you know, in the middle of a book or that type of thing. People also don't understand that when we got school books, that the information was often outdated because those school books they were hand-me-downs. And people just don't understand those things. So what are you not getting? You're not getting that there is a difference in the treatment of different classes and races in our society. Now, when I say different classes, poor white people go through very similar treatment. The only difference, John, is that poor white people can easily blend in. But African-American people, Mexican people, people of color, brown people, it's much harder to blend in because you and I, we don't, we don't look alike,
right?
When it comes to skin tone, so it's difficult. I can't blend into your society very easily. You know, they won't just look at me and say, "Oh, he's just one of us."
Right.
I'm always going to be different visually.
And I'm trying to end this on a lighter note because I look at you and thinking, you know, we all wanted to go where George Hoth. We all knew what you're doing, man. Years later, like, "Gee, one of our guys got to the Browns. You know, they got to go do this." And I guess what I'm trying to end this with here from on my side is I am so thankful for the Ray Smiths and the Prios, and to go to a Schurz High School in the middle of the city of Chicago that was integrated in a way that I've never once felt better or worse than any other human being on the planet. I think that's what you're asking us to do.
Absolutely. You know what? Be Ray Smith. Listen, as I told you that Ray Smith adopted, he basically adopted me during those school hours and doing those extracurricular activities. I never felt anything less coming from Ray Smith than any other person. I've never felt, I always felt that guy had my back and my support. You know what? Have somebody's back. I suggest to all of your listeners that they go out and they listen to somebody else's perspective without the input of their perspective. Now, after you totally listen, now you can share your perspective. But listen, open your heart, open your mind. And that's how the empathy is developed. You know, sit down with somebody you wouldn't normally sit down with and ask, you know, why do you feel the way you feel? Let me know. And once we start having those conversations, I'm going to tell you it's going to make all the difference. It will make all the difference in the world. And it's going to happen, John, by each individual seeking information. I don't know that we can educate people in the masses because, you know, minds are so closed. It probably takes more of a personal touch. But I think people need to go out with open minds and open hearts and sit down with somebody that's different. Sit down with somebody that's going through some things that they're not going through. And I think that we will, you know, we'll bring society a little closer to the middle. And that's what we got to get to.
So that conversation, I've listened to it 6 times. I did the editing process, of course. We actually talked for 90 minutes. You're getting about 52, 55 minutes of that. And we went on and on about all these things. And you know, here it is. We're about 10 years apart in age. We're 8, 9, 10 years apart in our experience at Schurz High School together. I've met him casually on occasion, but he made that post and I reached out to him. And interestingly enough, you know, we both kind of, look, I've been doing this for a long time. I don't know how many interviews George does, but everything he said resonated with me because I don't have the bias of like somehow I'm better or worse than him. However, if you're listening to this, maybe there was something in there for you, something that George said. The things that really stood out in that conversation are three of them. When you're not part of the oppressed, it's hard to see the oppression. So it's easy for all us to sit back who've never had that oppression and go, oh, I can't believe these people are acting this way. After this conversation, perhaps you can understand that a little bit more. The second thing that Big G said was the division is the greatest weapon of evil. You start dividing people, it's easy to conquer them. And so for all the flag waving and all the banners and all the flyovers and all the pomp and circum, we're the greatest nation on earth. You start dividing people, we look pretty small and pretty weak. And that's what division is all about. And this is nothing new. We're going to go into it like we've never gone into it before with this presidential election coming in a few months. And what politics is about dividing, separating, and then getting that demographic to follow you a certain way. And it's always been that way. It's not new, as I said. But at some point, you got to call bullshit on this stuff. Independent thought, taking some time to learn the facts, get out of your bias and grow up a bit. You know, we're not here very long. And the shining city on the hill that Reagan used to talk about is pretty well eroded, in my opinion. Just because we have all the technology in the world and we think we know everything doesn't mean we do. We have a long way to go. Bucky Fuller, this was in my head as George was talking to me. Bucky Fuller said, it's painfully obvious that our technology is far surpassing our humanity. So what if you got a $900 phone that could do 1,000 things? If you can't sit down with someone of a different color and find higher ground, what's the point of being here? And the third thing he said, our weaknesses is where we're exploited. Those fears, you know, there are people coming from the border. If we don't pick up a wall and put it up there, they're going to come in at night and kill you and take your children. What a pile of bullshit. You know how much goes on here on this side of the fence that's not even accounted for and just dismissed? Weaknesses are exploited. It's where the fear gets in. And what he said about immigration was profound to me. Here's a guy that knows what oppression is like and still bought in for a time that somehow that the Mexican people are the problem and that this immigration thing is, listen, it needs to be fixed without question. But you heard the story in there that I told about our friend, the late, great Phil Larson, who we had this whole thing set up with these DACA kids and giving them each $1,000, money we raised for their college efforts. And Phil was, you know, he was way, way right of center and proud of it. And I admired him for it. We got along great. I'm not too far from where he was at anyway. But the point is once you have an experience and you put yourself in the shoes of those kids and you have empathy for them, all that bullshit and bias fell away. Man, he'd love to hear this podcast. Here's the bottom line. It's not up to the politicians to do this. It's not up to the governments to do this. It's up to us, each individual, to do what we can do where you are with what you have. And that's where life really changes. That's where the world changes, on ground zero, right where you're at. Nowhere else. And so you want to be the change you see in the world? Then be the change. Don't wait for somebody else. Don't wait for a mandate. This is permission to find higher ground. So my thanks to Big George for taking the time out and stretching himself to do this. And thank you for listening. Matter of fact, real quick, we just ran over 7,000 downloads. Now, those aren't huge numbers compared to some of these podcasts. But you know what? I started this 2 years ago on Memorial Day. I am thrilled that people are subscribing and listening. And this is what I'm supposed to do with what I've been given. So thanks for supporting that. Until next time, keep your inner light shining. You never know how far it will go or who will need it. Safe travels. Adios.